I remember once we were down, you know, near where people were, and there was a merry-go-round, and he was looking at that, and that had been in one of his paintings that I'd seen. And I said, "Oh, it's the merry-go-round that you painted." And he said, "Yes, I always start with a subject." Now, we thought of him as an abstract painter, but he always started with a subject. And then he became abstract. The painting took over, I think.
Welcome to episode 86 of Talking with Painters, where Australian painters talk about their lives and art. I'm Maria Stolger, and my guest today is Anne Thompson. This is the second part of a double episode on 20th century artist Ian Fairweather. In the last episode, I interviewed Claire Roberts, who's the co-editor of the book Ian Fairweather, A Life in Letters, and we talked about the events of Fairweather's life from his early childhood. In this episode, I talk with Anne Thompson, who is one of Australia's leading contemporary artists and who I previously interviewed on this podcast in episode 54. Anne met Fairweather on several occasions with her then-husband, photographer Robert Walker. They visited him on Queensland's Bribie Island, where he lived for the last 20 years of his life in self-made huts before he died in 1974. He's considered one of Australia's most important artists, and although he was often described as an outsider or a recluse, he was actually quite sociable through his letters and welcomed friends who came to visit. In the previous episode, if you've heard it, you will have heard about him famously sailing off into the open sea from Darwin on a raft he built himself, heading for Portuguese Timor over 600 kilometres away. It would be 16 days before he would reach land after his raft sailed off course and he had almost lost his life. The RAAF were called in and an obituary even appeared in the newspaper. It became an international story. What he tells Anne Thompson when she asked him about this ordeal is priceless. Anne's memories are interesting, insightful and humorous and gave me a better idea of the man who was Ian Fairweather. We start this conversation with Anne telling me how she came about to meet him.
So when Robert Walker and I, a photographer, were first married, and he was passionate about documenting people, really. You know, first a lot of artists. He wanted to photograph and interview artists. A bit like you, really. Mm. You know, that's what he loved to do. I remember once though when we were living in Paddington. He interviewed the blacksmith up the road, so it was history that, you know, might disappear, and he wanted to keep that.
Mm.
And so my family came from Brisbane, and I had left Brisbane to go to art school, and so every time we had a chance to go up and see my family and then go over to Bribie Island.
Was it because of Ian Fairweather that you went to Bribie Island, or was it
absolutely,
just...
Absolutely, that's why, because Robert wanted to photograph Ian Fairweather. So the first I remember is that we arrived at Bribie Island, then we had to find where Fairweather lived, and someone had said there was a bent log, you know, that made an archway.
Oh, yeah.
And he could be found if you went through there. So we found this and went through, and Robert called out, "Mr. Fairweather," and nothing. And then out he came, sort of, you know, blinking into the sunlight from his hut. And I can clearly remember the first time I saw those blue eyes just so looking at things around him all the time. You know, he was so much part of that place where he lived and the other creatures who were there and the undergrowth and the atmosphere and
Well, Claire Roberts was describing him as an early environmentalist, that he must have been really connected to the
He was
nature.
Really connected to animals. You know, they were the other creatures that he could put up with, really, on a long-term basis.
Yeah, right. So when you were there, you'd see him, what, interact with, like, sort of other animals and that sort
of... Well, at one stage... So this won't be sequential because they're just sort of, you know, memories and things remembered. But Robert said, you sit over there on the beach and talk to Fairweather and I'll hide over here so I can photograph him. and I was a shy young, you know, just in early 20s and, I wasn't the person I am now. I was really, I found all that difficult. And
well, he would have been like over 40 years older than you.
Yes, he was. So he was an old person then, but he became much older, of course, than you know, the first time we met him. And so we would sit there talking, and he would say something, and then I'd say something. He mightn't answer for a further 20 minutes. He'd just sit there, and I had to, my stomach would tense, and what can I say now? And then, so we were just sitting there, and you know, I just learned to do as he did, just sit and look, and he said, "See that fish? I think he's sick," because he looked at further at the ocean. Actually, I've got a photo of him sitting there, so he walked down and picked it up. So, you know, and another time he'd be looking at a bird or, you know, he was absolutely aware of all the creatures around him. Mm. And he said to me, I was here when the last red kangaroo was here. So he must have been distressed at that, at the departing of the last red kangaroo.
Yeah.
So Bribey Island was a very wild, you know, and unpopulated place in those days, although it had a shop and a local store and not what you'd call a village, but there was a pharmacy.
Oh, yeah.
And the pharmacist, Al Fleming, if I remember, was somebody Fairweather saw quite a lot because he would get him to take him places. But I'm just thinking, how would he contact him? Would he walk to him and say, come and get me? I don't know.
They might have had an arrangement or something.
Oh, they had an arrangement, yeah, something like that. Yeah. So that was his transport if he wanted to go further.
What if he wanted to leave the island, for example, mean?
Well, possibly, yes, if he wanted to go and, you know, go to Brisbane or London or something, suddenly Al would have to drive him.
So when you first went, was that before the bridge was built connecting Bribey Island to the mainland?
Oh, yes, it was before then.
Oh, yeah, right. Mm. So can you describe to me, because I was talking to Claire Roberts about the huts that he lived in.
Yes.
Can you describe them for me? Like, what were your first impressions when you saw them and what were they like?
Well, he came out of the hut, which was his dwelling place, his living hut, the first, you know, when we saw him the first time. And so in front of that, there was a space where there was, his fireplace and things that he'd discarded. He didn't do a lot of tidying up. But there'd be tins of Peking duck. He got food from Fortnum and Mason as well as, you know, down the road from...
So it was sent to him, basically, must from have been his sent family to him. Or something.
Yes. Yeah. And English newspapers and magazines. He was absolutely up with what was going on in London at that stage.
Mm.
And... you know, could talk about things. And he did like to talk about his old art school, the Slade, and Tonkins, I think, was his teacher.
I think that's right. I think Claire said that. And what did he say about it?
Oh, he had great respect and love of his art teachers in school, I think. I think he believed that he had a good art training.
Mm.
Although he left it far behind because he was painting in a way that not many of his contemporaries would have even imagined.
Mm. So did he invite you into his living area? I mean, would you go in there?
Not straight away. but I do remember once going in there and he had a sort of desk that he'd made and he was translating the Drunken Buddha from Chinese. And so you could see that all laid out and his work, and boy, oh boy, when I went in there, my eyes were sharp and looking. And,
I can imagine.
And there was a ladder going up to his where he slept up high, but it wasn't very big. But across the room was a string of Christmas cards, And I said, oh, I did that one. Because a friend of mine had given it to him, and it was a silkscreen print.
It was a print of your work on the Christmas card?
Yeah, I'd printed it. It was a handprint card that I must have sold or something.
You must have got a shock when you saw it.
Oh, yeah, well, I was nicely surprised, so I mentioned it. And I said, but it's only a design, I said shyly. And he said, all artists design. And we used to talk a bit about art. If only I could remember everything he said. But wasn't I lucky, though, just to be there and to know him and to be with him and observe him and listen to the stories around him
He was happy to have you and Robert there?
He seemed to be, yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, there were certain people that he would, get rid of quite quickly, I believe, or take them for such a hard walk that they'd, finish them off. I know one person.
He didn't want to be rude.
Fairweather would be able to spot the people he didn't care for.
Mm.
And one of them was his brother.
Really?
Mm. And so his brother arrived. He'd been sent on a mission to find this younger, the younger brother who'd left the family and never been, with, and they didn't know what he was up to or doing. His brother brought him some clothes, and Fairweather looked at them disdainfully, said, well, you can give those to the Salvation Army. I have everything I need here. And he actually had a very English accent. My friend Pam Bell said he spoke like an Oxford Don. So he had that really English background.
Right, yeah, sort of the upper class.
Yes, those strange, childhood that I can tell you about. But anyway, so they talked and then the brother who was staying somewhere else and said, oh, well, I'll come back tomorrow. And Fairweather said, no, I'm too busy. What is that?
Apparently he was close with a couple of his sisters, I think, according to the letters.
The sisters?
Or Queenie in particular.
Yes. Mm. Yes, he wasn't. He just didn't. Apparently he didn't like this brother because he talked about money. He talked about filthy lucre. And the poor brother was saying, oh, yes, I've done well and I did this and I did that,
But he wasn't impressed. So he didn't come across as a materialistic sort of person.
He did not. We would go there, arrive and say, and Robert would say, would you like to go for a drive, Mr. Fairweather? So we had this old green Renault and so he'd say, yes, thank you. One day I said, I've made a picnic. And he said, no, thank you. He wouldn't accept anything like that. So we took him to the shop. He said, I'll go and buy a pie. And we went to the shop. Hello, Ian. How are you? he said, I'll have a pie, thank you. And out came, and she passed in the pie. He put his hand in his pocket and held, without looking at it, held out the greatest wad of notes I'd ever seen. She peeled something off and he put it back again without looking at it.
So he was obviously earning a reasonable income from his work.
Macquarie Gallery, sent him money. And there were times on Bribey when he was really didn't have money, and I suppose that was in the early days because people were queuing for his work. By the time we got there, he was famous.
Yeah.
Not that he ever went to the Macquarie Gallery himself. But he said to me, and we were sitting somewhere talking, he said, what's the lighting like in the Macquarie Galleries? So he was really worried about that. Mm. He hated bright lights. And when he used to bring out things for Robert to photograph, I think we got on quite well with him. He probably quite enjoyed our visits.
Yeah, it sounds like
I'm sure he didn't think about us after we'd gone, but I think he was a hermit who liked people sometimes.
Mm.
And of course he was lonely and isolated, so he was... But he wouldn't have anything that he didn't approve of or like.
Yeah.
And so Robert... we used to always bring him science fiction books.
All right.
Because that's what he read. And I was thinking this morning, I think he had that creative thing where he found it hard to start working. Because he often didn't start till night, but then he used to light the hurricane lamp, and of course he got to like that.
Yeah. So when you say hurricane light, that sort of lamp, a sort of a lamp, is it like a kerosene lamp or something?
I don't know what a hurricane light is. No.
Probably most of my listeners would know, but I don't actually know.
Okay. Well, it has a glass thing. It hangs up. You can hang it up,
yeah.
And then there's a glass thing that you have to lift to light a match and light the wick, and then put the glass frame around it, so the light would be, you know, fairly uncertain. I wouldn't like to paint by it, but
yeah.
I think.
And so,
would I? I should try.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, it'd be interesting to paint in those conditions because colour would be different and.
Yes, but I don't think you have to have, you know, proper light in order to paint. You just have to be able to see. You know, you don't have to have, there's no certain light, you know, like you have to have south light when you're in England and I suppose north light here, but I don't find that. Actually, I just turn the lights on.
Yeah, you don't need daylight. You don't need natural light.
I don't care. Well, I can I don't seem to worry about it. I just, as long as I can see the paint and the thing I'm painting on.
Well, in a funny way, if you are painting in artificial light, that's what it's going to look like in the gallery, more likely than if
I don't like things. Things can be too overlit, too. And Fairweather would have certainly been horrified at some of the galleries today lighting his work. Although his work looks good in any gallery I've ever seen it in.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And that, you know, those wonderful paintings in the Queensland Gallery and. Laurie Thomas was so good at buying his work. The New South Wales Gallery was well behind, and so they've got a good collection of fabulous, important works. You know, Monastery and those.
Yeah. And did you
big paintings?
Yeah, and so the studio was a separate hut.
So then there was another hut that you'd walk into and. You know, that was just like a cathedral. Paintings everywhere on the wall, and they were just like, why did I say that? But perhaps they were like stained glass windows or something. They were just because there was so much light in them in a way. You know his work, and it's and he would have been. Painting on those and over them and changing them, and because you could see all the dribbles that had passed, you know, through, and he was just painting, you know, he's such a wonderful painter. And at one stage I read that because he had run out of money, he'd paint on anything with anything. He didn't even care if it lasted or flaked off, really, because it was just doing it. Oh, you know, well, they can look after that. But he didn't. That would have been almost a pompous thought. He didn't say that. He just didn't. He just did them.
Yeah.
But then he must have cared about them because he wanted the light to be right on them.
Mm.
Complex.
Mm. So a lot of it was on cardboard, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. And that's good. Painting, you know, painting with house paint on cardboard is a nice touch. You know, it lends something to the work. And I quite like doing that.
Yeah.
I don't think he had much to do with canvas. The Macquarie Gallery sent him some down because he was sending up these things on crappy stuff. And he just put it on top of his hut to keep the rain out. And they sent him two pairs of pyjamas, so he sent one pair back. Thank you.
And so, well, we were looking at a couple of photos that you've got here, which are unbelievable. And that hut that he was painting in, it shows that there were a lot of works going at the one time.
Yes, yes.
And so that's the way he worked?
So he seemed to have a low table with paint pots and brushes and then paintings on the walls. Can I look at that photo?
Yeah.
What is it?
Is it here?
I think you've got
maybe
one.
This one?
These are seconds that have been printed that they're my daughter's.
Mm. Well, the one I'm looking at, so I'll just pass it to you.
Yes. You see, you can see there's a painting flat, so he's painting flat down, but it's not high. And then there are paintings all around the walls. there's, you know, I mean, I can see in this photograph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and there would have been others, you know.
And they're quite large as well.
And then
aren't
he
they?
Would have just taken them down, as I do, you know, you just keep painting on that one and then that one and then that one. And and he would have just seen what they need out of the corner of his eye, I'd think, and then get back to it. But they're it's definitely a body of work.
And do you
and there
did
are
you
faces get... and, you know, people in there that he used a lot.
Yeah, so there was a sort of figurative element to his work.
Always. Always something. And I remember once we were down, you know, near where people were, and there was a merry-go-round, and he was looking at that, and that had been in one of his paintings that I'd seen. And I said, oh, it's the merry-go-round that you painted. And he said, yes, I always start with a subject. Now, we thought of him as an abstract painter, but he always started with a subject. And then he became abstract. The painting took over, I think.
Mm. And did he ever paint when you were there?
No.
What was he using most of the time? Like what paint? Was it oils or gouache?
I think things he'd bought at the local hardware shop.
house paint?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, right. He didn't use good paint. But that was really good. I mean, it looked so good. It flat. You know, it's almost like sometimes I use PVA with pigment, you know, so it's like a mixed flat look that it has.
Mm.
But on paper, you know, his works on paper or newspaper, I mean, they were just wonderful. Just the touch of the paint marrying the ground that it was on, or the, you know, the thing that it was on, the paper or the cardboard, you know, that was so important to him, I'm sure, because that's what you see when you look at his work. It's like breathing onto it. And has that's why it's imbued with such feeling and something more than looking at something or using a subject, or it goes well beyond that, and it's really to do with his living alone and giving everything to that. So he just, it wasn't, oh, I want to be an artist, and I want to, it was just something that he was bound to do. And it was more important to him than anything or practically anyone else you could think of, you know, the way he worked.
So it was a daily activity. Like it.
Oh, well, once he was being interviewed, the Courier Mail every now and again for anything, would interview him if he had a successful exhibition or something, or for some reason. And this interviewer said, because I've heard this interview somehow, and he said, and what do you do all day? Said the interviewer. He said, a big pause. I paint, damn it. You know, so clearly he didn't paint all day, but that's what he did, you know, in his, that's where his mind was.
Yeah.
I paint, damn it.
And he also, it sounds like he was a big reader as well.
Yes, but he liked to read, and I must say I read this in the Abbott Smith book that I was browsing through yesterday. He liked to read science fiction and crime novels so that he could keep an eye on the animals at the same time, he said.
What do you mean?
On nature, you know, so that he could keep looking at nature. So he didn't really go right off into, he wasn't studying anything else. He was just being there all the time.
Right.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's like a sort of constant meditation, really, that was not to be interrupted, thank you very much. But he certainly would talk to Robert a lot, because Robert was the interviewer, you know, he was interviewing him.
Mm.
And we used to drive along in this old Renault, rattly, 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 and Robert would have the tape recorder on. Well, those tapes are so interesting because they say, brum, 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 brum. Not a single thing came through, just the motor of the Renault.
Oh, gosh, that'd be disappointing.
I believe that they can be can be sought out now.
Yeah, or maybe if you take it to a, you know, sound it's engineer. Not mine. Well, whoever has them, no, but, a sound engineer might be able
wife
to.
Wife number one. But Louise might. I mean, no, we get on well. I mentioned that to her.
Yeah.
Because it would
imagine
be.
Imagine that.
There were very interesting things that they talked about. And Robert remembered more than I, but he's gone now.
In the letters, I was reading the book and there's a lot of reference, and we talked about this in my interview with Claire, is references to sort of being depressed and, you know, in one letter he was saying, I'm in such a depression I can hardly write.
Yes.
Did he ever, like, would you ever visit him and he wasn't, you know, he was in that mood or you felt he was in that frame of mind?
Well, I suppose he'd come out of his hut and he was probably sleeping, you know, and he did, you know, he said, you know, sleep in something I read, not that he told me, but that he slept a lot in the daytime and that's why he painted at night.
Mm.
I think he was depressed. I mean, what a childhood he had.
Mm.
8 brothers and sisters, and when he was born they all headed off and left him with his... Robert went to Jersey Island to meet his relatives.
Oh, did he?
Mm. Yeah. And I think he might have met the old aunts. They gave him something. I never saw those things, the Fairweathers. And so I think he got on all right with them. But he said they were scary old aunts.
Oh, right.
You know, it was an old aunt and a nurse. I mean, you know, and I mean, they used to just take him to school, pick him up. You know, there was no sort of fun.
Mm.
I think he started to mix with other people when he went to Switzerland. Why was that? I think he joined the army. His family were intent on him joining the army, and they didn't think, as a lot of parents would say, "Oh no, we don't want you to be an artist." You know, what good would that do? And so he joined the army and went. Had a chance to go to and stay in Switzerland, and he loved that because he climbed mountains and he seemed to be start to mix with people. But he was never really easy with other people, I think. I mean, a lot of people thought he was strange and he wouldn't have been well treated.
Yeah. Do you remember, actually, I'm not sure if you might have been a teenager when he went on that little raft.
Oh, yes. No, I remember when he went on that and I went to visit him. Well, I don't know, but certainly I remember going, talking to him when he had already been on that trip. And I said, "Would you ever do that again, Mr. Fairweather?" and he said, "Next time I'd take a pair of sunglasses."
Oh, that's amazing.
I mean, it must have been so glary. And
well, could
terrible.
You imagine being yes, on that raft
I mean,
for
sun
so many
and
weeks?
The elements and I mean, he was an amazing adventurer in his life. You know, I mean, the things that he did were so brave and daring and, you know, things that that other people are afraid of. And so... Yes, he said he was depressed a lot or in the
well,
letters.
Well, yeah, that would often come up.
I haven't read the book yet.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the other thing is when you, I mean, it's hard to know when he says depressed if it just means he's downhearted or something, you know. Who knows what the use of the word is, I don't know.
Oh, if he said depressed, he would have meant depressed. And he probably possibly couldn't paint and, you know, those times come when everything's flowing along and then it stops. And you can't paint like that anymore and you can't paint like the next thing anymore. And those are very hard bits for an artist.
Mm.
And so he would have had gone through those stages as well and he would have felt depressed. But I think he was. He wasn't a cheery or entertaining soul or anything. He was living in a very hard place in his head and not accepting anything from anyone else. He did like to play chess with the local pharmacist. Mm.
In the town?
In the town, yes. Right. They'd get together and play chess.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think he had that background of you know, growing up being that English background and that never left him, of course. So chess would have been part of that. But then he went, and he decided at one stage to go back to London, and he only wanted to live in, you know, in the middle of London where he'd gone to art school and everything. So that didn't work. So he finally came back to Bribie Island. It wasn't the place of his choice. It happened to be where he landed in one of the places he went to, because another place was Cairns, when he lived in that great, great, huge, hollow, empty old picture theatre full of rats, and, you know, that must have been awful. I didn't think he liked that for too long.
I know, it's interesting, the places he lived, you know. He wasn't seeking out comfort necessarily or anything like that.
No, because he knew that he could make it as comfortable as he needed. I mean, when in the end they made him leave his hut because they said it was unhealthy. Of course it was unhealthy, you know. But he'd lived there all his life, you know, and he managed.
Oh, so they made him leave it?
Yes, people got together, the council, and, you know, and I think some people sort of thought, oh, yes, it'd be good if he'd moved out of there because it's damp and he had arthritis, you know. I'm sure they meant well, but they built him a house and he didn't want to go in there at all. It had a cement floor and then they brought him a bed. He didn't want a bed. You know, he slept on stuff that he made. And so then one day when I didn't go with Robert, perhaps I wasn't with Robert anymore, but I thought I said to my cousin, let's go to Bribie Island because I want to see Mr. Fairweather. And my cousin John Bennett didn't know anything about art or Fairweather or anything. So he came with me, and so I found him, and then and he invited me into the house. There was a mattress with things on it. It was pretty awful. And we must have talked a bit, but then he said to me, I've lost the elan.
And he wasn't painting at that point?
No, not it left, you know. I mean, he might have been, but he'd lost, you know, the thing that he had, and that he knew, you know. I mean, it goes perhaps at the very end.
Yeah, and yeah, so that would have
been
not long.
Because he was ill then,
yeah.
And then soon after that, he went to hospital, but he didn't, you know, he didn't say it in a way that I want to paint or I need it, or it's just part of what. What a long life as an artist he had.
Well, that's right. Well, he would have been close to 90 then, wouldn't he?
He was 80-something. I'm not sure how old. But he seemed older too, because his health wasn't good, and then he forgot to eat it at one stage. He just had banana and milk, and I think he couldn't be bothered going to the shop. And people should have brought him things, but then he wouldn't have accepted it. Al, the taxi driver, bought him Christmas lunch once that his wife had lovingly made, and he brought it and set it down. He said, I'm not taking that. And so Al said, listen, Mr. Fairweather, you've been a good fare to me and I want you to eat that, have that. And he walked away and left him with it, so he did.
Oh, isn't that interesting? He just didn't want to take anything.
No. So talk about an independent soul.
Yeah, amazing.
Mm. And, of course, all that is part of the artist that he is. And, you know, it just put me in mind then of Van Gogh and people who were odd, strange and separated from the rest of the society on a full-time basis, you know. I mean, artists can separate themselves some in part, but not many separate themselves utterly.
No, that's right. Were you aware of many other people that visited him, or did you...?
Yes, other people visited him. I know that Roy Churcher and Betty, but it was Roy he enjoyed talking to. Rudy Koman used to go and visit. Oh, people, you know, respected him and revered him. You know, people in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane. So they would all go and, you know, visit from time to time. And Rudy used to take, it took him whiskey, which, being a Scotsman, he liked whiskey. He knew that. And then he took him cases of wine, which Fairweather enjoyed. And and appreciate it.
Just lastly, I'd be I don't know if you can answer this actually, but do you think there was any that he had any influence on your work?
Yes, of course, but I didn't copy it. But I think all the people that came into my young life influenced me, you know, all the good people that you were allowed in, like at art school, Passmore and Godfrey Miller and Dadsall and people, and John Mulvig, when I had him as a teacher in Brisbane, and Fairweather, certainly, you know, when they were... And then the American Expressionists, who were somehow very much in our lives, in my life in those days, and I was always, you know, looking at what they were doing in magazines and things, and then finally I think an exhibition came. But so you'd grasp onto anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, what influenced you and what stayed there and what... I remember looking at in depth for a long, long time at the early Sienese painters. Well, I don't see that in my work, but the fact that I was really looking at that must mean something.
You were drawn to it
but
somehow.
It doesn't come out in, you know, in the look of the work. So everything's part of it, I would say. And certainly I feel I was very lucky to know Fairweather.
Yeah. Well, Anne, thank you so much for sharing your memories about Fairweather, because it's just absolutely wonderful to hear.
Good. I enjoyed it.
What interesting memories. It's always great catching up with Anne Thompson. By the way, Anne's solo show Air and Space opens at Mitchell Fine Art Gallery in Brisbane on 25 March, and she'll also be giving an artist talk on 28 March. There are some great works going into that show, so it's well worth a look. Thanks for listening, and hope you can join me for the next episode of Talking with Painters.
Did you go to any of his big shows? I mean, you know, I hear that,
yes.
You know, one of his shows, they were queuing the night before.
Yes, I didn't queue because we had no money to spend on a Fairweather. But I would advise others and I'd say, buy that one and you should buy that. And I mean, why didn't I beg, borrow. I'm really not a collector. But there were some wonderful things that I saw in those exhibitions, yes.
Yeah. Was he ever at them? When you were there?
Never, no. No, I don't think he ever went.